This is Growing Up Strong.
Hi everyone, and welcome to, or welcome back to, the Growing Up Strong podcast, episode 2. Today we have Rob Anderson, strength and conditioning coach with Scottish Rugby Union. And we cover a number of really interesting topics. I really hope you enjoy it. Feel free to leave some feedback either on the podcast itself or to me on Twitter at coach_Joycey. That's J-O-Y-C-E-Y. Thank you for listening, and again, I hope you enjoy. Okay, hi everyone. I'm here with Rob Anderson, strength and conditioning coach with Scottish Rugby Union. Rob, thank you very much for joining me, first of all. And number one topic of discussion, your journey as a coach, as a practitioner, from where you started to where you are, the path you took and what was along the way. And I know as you're part-time at the moment and you do a lot, some other things on the side, how you find that balance, because I know there's a lot of people out there that are doing the same thing.
Well, I'm guessing we've probably all seen that kind of graphic of success, and there are kind of people saying, you know, what success thinks like, and you know, what people think success looks like, and it's very linear compared to what it is, which is very kind of backwards and forwards and squiggly lines. That's definitely my career to date, in terms of kind of moving sideways and moving backwards and forwards. So to give you an idea, I started off as a PT in David Lloyd many kind of moons ago, and it was there that I kind of found out or heard the term strength conditioning for the first time through a friend of mine, Matt Church, who now runs Locker 27 in Weybridge, a very good strength and conditioning facility. And he kind of introduced me to the idea of training athletes in strength and conditioning. So I was pretty curious about that. And at the time, he was looking at doing a course at St. Mary's Uni. So I kind of, you know, hung about on the sidelines and had a little look at what he was doing, got really interested with that, and kind of showed a few sessions at Surrey County Cricket that he was doing, and kind of decided that was the route I wanted to do. So I signed myself up to a degree in strength and conditioning science at St. Mary's, did that for 3 years, so worked with some very good practitioners there, and John Goodwin and Rich Blagrove, who've gone on to bigger and better things. So during that period of time, did an internship with Watford, part-time at Watford Football Club, Harlequins Rugby League before they became London Broncos, and coached some uni teams. So I coached the Women's Rugby Union squad and then the Men's Rugby League squad. Got through my degree, as probably most guys and girls are, and didn't have a job lined up. Wasn't too really sure what I wanted to do next, but knew I wanted to kind of keep going in that direction. And luckily, a kind of master's came along that was going to work for me. So I stayed around at St. Mary's to do a master's in exercise physiology. And from there, before I finished the end of that, I kind of landed my first full-time paid role. So that was at the Leaf Studio School, and probably a good friend of mine, Tom Smale. So we basically were involved in starting up from scratch a strength and conditioning program at the school within a kind of sports performance academy. So that was a really great role, which I had for about 18 months. Primarily working with volleyball is kind of the big sport, which is unusual in the UK. So got exposure to both the indoor and the beach versions of volleyball, which was really cool to work in a different sport. At the same time, did a little bit of contractor work on the side for GB Gymnastics within their trampoline program in Bournemouth. So I was lucky enough to work with a few high-performing young athletes, which Nathan Bailey went off to the last Olympics and did really well. The first British guy in a long time to get the top 10. So he did fantastic. And then from there, I basically was getting really interested in youth athletes and their development and maturation. And an opportunity came up at a professional football club to do a PhD in their academy. So I kind of went and pitched my idea, which was along the lines of, you know, you've just spent multi-million pounds on your academy facilities, and you run the risk of putting the wrong players through that coaching process purely because of the bias in selecting bigger players, faster players, stronger players at ages when that is not necessarily a level playing field. So it kind of started along the route of doing a PhD at that particular professional club. Unfortunately, a couple of months in, it became apparent that wasn't really going to work for a number of reasons. So I left that and then ended up going into private health for a little bit. So kind of had a bit of a sour taste in my mouth after that experience in strength and conditioning, and went to work for Natural Health as a physiologist for a while. And then kind of my urge for SNC came back and really wanted to get back into coaching. So I was lucky enough to pick up some stuff on the side with London Thunder Basketball Club through the England ACE basketball program. And then kind of finally progressing into where I am now, my girlfriend took a PhD in orthopedic medicine up here in Edinburgh, and kind of we decided that we were going to pack things up and head up here. So kind of started from scratch up here, and I've managed to pick up some work as a part-time contractor with Scotland Rugby Union in their Borders Academy, and then also doing my own like bits and pieces on the side in terms of strength and conditioning classes and youth athlete development sessions and personal training.
Wow, that's awesome. I know you described it as a squiggly line, but I'm sure that the experience of a number of different sports, and I mean, you mentioned volleyball in there, you mentioned trampolining in there, to have to know the background and the needs analysis of those sports and to go away and research that before knowing how to develop those athletes, that's surely going to stand you in good stead as you move forward as well.
Yeah, totally. I think having a different range of sports and completely different cultures as well. Working in gymnastics is a big eye-opener in terms of just the level of preparation those guys do on really basic stuff. So what they do for a warm-up would be an incredibly strenuous session for other sports.
Yeah.
So you work with people who have an incredible level of basic conditioning, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So then I'm guessing it's an eye-opener when you go into other sports, and it's the other end of the spectrum, or it can be. Okay, that's awesome. Second question or second topic, I wanted to talk about your job with the Scottish Rugby, the performance pathway within that. From a physical development point of view, how young do you get the players in? Are you involved in the selection process, or is there a physical side that's involved to that? When do they start their strength work? Do you monitor their loads? And is that just you doing that, or how big is the team? Are we talking sort of a top end multidisciplinary, or is it just you and you doing a few bits?
Yeah, so in terms of athlete selection, I'm not involved in that process at all. So that's kind of a whole different bag. And primarily my role as a contractor is really around the kind of strength and conditioning, more kind of gym-based than kind of track or speed sessions, although I do occasionally cover those if someone's off sick and, you know, or off away on holiday. In terms of the kind of setup here, so Scotland's kind of broken up into regions. So we have the Borders Academy, which is where I'm kind of situated. Then you've got kind of central hubs in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And then kind of beyond that, you've got the kind of Caledonia region as well. So it's kind of broken up into regional academies, if you like. The Borders Academy is a little bit unique in that setup, in that we have, in association with the council, we have what's called the PACE program, which stands for Performance Athletes in Schools. So we've got a little bit of leeway that other academies probably don't have, which is quite a nice thing to have. So some of our guys are lucky enough to be allowed to miss the first kind of period at school on a Tuesday and Thursday morning and come and do strength conditioning work, and then they get bussed off to school. So that's a luxury that we have that the other academies probably don't have, and that's purely because of the association with the council. So at that level, the kind of PACE level, that kind of blends in with what we call stage one, where guys are undergoing roughly sort of two to three strength and conditioning sessions a week and two kind of technical sessions as well. On top of that, they have access to physio, but it's not a full-time thing, so they can't just, you know, skip the S&C session and go and see the physio. It's not quite as fluid as that. Beyond that level, it starts to change a little bit. So at stage two, it starts to progress a bit more. And, you know, you're looking at guys who should be looking more at under 16, under 18 kind of national representatives. So that's the kind of level that guys should be at. And then when you get to stage three, you're looking at kind of basically a full-time program. So obviously, as guys progress to that stage three, they have access to physio on, you know, on a daily basis. There's a very kind of fluid process there, and that the strength and conditioning coaches and the physios are tagged in the same department, the same area. So, for example, in one of our kind of satellite areas, if you like, in Gullah Shields, there's a physio on site there with their kind of rehab room on site. Whereas where I'm based in Meadowmill, there's kind of slots available for people to see physios at certain times in the week. So it's not quite as fluid as that. So yeah, as players kind of progress through, obviously they're starting to leave school and kind of consider their options after that. So stage one and stage two is kind of school age, if you like, and working around their education. And then stage three is, you know, if players are kind of considering, you know, university or working alongside. So there's that other kind of stress to consider as well in terms of where the guys are at in terms of physically dealing with all these other issues. But primarily the area that I'm kind of doing my contractor work in is with the PACE program and stage one / stage two kind of guys.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, and with those guys, obviously they're still at school age, a lot of them. What sort of strength work, well, where does your strength work centre around? Have you got enough contact time to take the time to teach some key lifts? Is it your philosophy there to use Olympic lifts, or where do you go with that?
So as the guy kind of enters in, certainly the big focus is on movement quality. So for example, Ben Parks, another guy who's working in the academy, not full time, but a lot more of them he's kind of put together some kind of core competencies in terms of what players should be able to do at different levels. So they revolve around the ones you probably imagine in terms of a push, pull, that kind of squat, in terms of the quality of movement. So although there's a load element, it's not excessive, and the focus is really on the quality of movement. So in terms of programming, a lot of those guys will do, you know, the kind of Olympic lift variations, usually a hang clean or clean pulls. And then they'll have a variation of front squat, back squats, along with some kind of rowing and tuning variations and any kind of accessory work. Obviously, being a collision sport, even this, that kind of age group, you're going to pick up your knocks and your injuries. So sometimes those sessions get thrown out the window, and, you know, someone's got an AC joint, so their upper body session's clearly not going to happen. So they might, you know, drill some single leg, lower body work. In terms of the players that I'm working with, I'm really at the end where they kind of first come into the system. So basically, you're kind of starting from scratch. And I've got a big focus on almost 50-50 in terms of strength, technique, work, and mobility. So, I will pretty much get the guys that I'm working with supersetting a mobility exercise with a technical kind of strength exercise, to try and work on some of the key issues that we see, which, you know, tight ankles, tight hips, hamstrings being an issue, thoracic rotation being an issue. So trying to really get players into the mindset of doing those kind of work-ons early on, to allow them and to set them up to be able to shift heavier loads with better technique later on.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I quite like the idea of supersetting mobility and technical lifts, or I've seen it in the past with lifting and then a sort of a movement competency or a stability type exercise, so I've seen that as well. I do like the mixing up of supersets. Is there any plyometrics is a big topic of discussion at the moment? I was just wondering, do you do that in terms of load acceptance with an early guys, or is there anything within the sessions that is built towards that, or you could call a plyometric exercise, or is it more about that competency before you start doing any of that?
So we are lucky in our setup in that we have Jamie, who is a very, very high level sprinter in terms of a Commonwealth sprinter. So he looks after the guys on the track, and we'll kind of turn them around sort of 45 minutes of the session. So the boys will go out and do 45 minutes on the track or 45 minutes in the gym, and then they'll switch around and vice versa. In terms of, you know, the kind of work they're doing out there, as you can imagine, there's a lot of kind of hurdle mobility, a lot of kind of basic technical drills. So, you know, your A skips, your B skips, your hops, those kind of things. Really working on their technique. So they're getting some low level plyometrics in those kind of hurdle drills, but the emphasis isn't necessarily the plyometric ability itself, if that makes sense. So we're kind of, you know, ticking two boxes, and that they'll get their hip mobility, or they'll get their technical reinforcement with some low-level kind of ankle plyos at the same time.
Yeah, okay. Sounds like a great setup, that. Lucky to have a sprint coach that you work so closely with. I bet you're learning off him as well if you get to see the sessions outside.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, annoyingly being in the gym, you don't get to see as much as you'd like because obviously you're kind of working, but, you kind of hear from the boys the feedback on what they've been doing and seeing the testing results. So obviously what he's doing is working, and obviously with his technical knowledge, they're getting some good feedback and some great kind of progressions and regressions, etc.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, next topic. You mentioned the age of the boys that you work with, and I was thinking about your opinion or your views on early specialisation in sport. So these boys are coming out of school to do rugby. They're around the rugby. They're doing gym in preparation for rugby. And although it's, you're not replicating movements in the gym, they are. It's hopefully, you'd like to think it was functional strength work and training. So I was just thinking on your opinion of early specialisation, and do you encourage your lad to go and do other things at all?
So I guess it's a difficult one because we're at that age where the guys are starting to, even in most models, will be starting to specialise because they're at that 14, 15, 16 kind of mark. So they've been looking to. I wouldn't say the guys are actively encouraged to go away and try other things or to be involved in other things, but it's certainly not discouraged. We do have two very good athletes who came from completely different sports. And when I mean completely different, I mean there's not a ball involved. Judo and boxing, those two guys have come through and are well put together athletes. So we certainly, I wouldn't discourage it, but I guess they're at that age where, you know, things are starting to become limited in terms of time and academic exams and training load, etc., and how much availability there is. So there's certainly the age where they would start to be choosing their sport. Personally, from my point of view, I would always encourage, up until that age group of 15, 16, to be trying your hand at different things and almost actually as varied activities as possible, when I think about, if I had a kid, what would the template be? I kind of think I'd love to have, a kid that could do some base level gymnastics, that could do some, little athletics kind of exercises, the capacity of swimming, and then, the decision making of ball sport games. So if you've got kind of those boxes checked, you've got four different activities in a week that are producing different loads, different, patterns, cyclical and acyclical and decision making, they're all feeding off different areas, if you like, of the kind of performance sphere. And I think it's to a detriment to cut any one of those off. I'm just starting to work in my own kind of private practice with a youth tennis player who's only, must be 14. Yeah, he's 14. And he has spent the last 9 weeks on the sideline with tendocinovitis. And when, the first thing I said when I woke him, I said, okay, write down your training schedule. And, until recently they hadn't done any other non-tennis related exercises or activities. And there was 5 days of tennis in a row. So that's the other extreme end of the environment. Is you're looking at guys who are in certain sports, which certainly encourage, repetitive and high level training loads that are producing those kind of injuries at younger and younger ages, which is obviously less than ideal. And we've all seen those articles from orthopedic surgeons and baseball coaches in America talking about pitch count and seeing it coming into cricket now with bowlers. And I think people are hopefully becoming more aware of, the kind of counterintuitiveness of actually it's better to be sampling a number of different sports than specializing potentially, unless, you're in your gymnastics or your ice, your figure skating, etc., that are early specialization sports.
Yeah, so true. In a lot of what you said there, there is a lot more of awareness talking to people in my working environment and outside of it. There's a lot more awareness of that now, of that repetitive load and athletes doing that at a younger age. So probably a positive thing that people are becoming aware of it and things are being done about it and put in place.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one. I mean, I'm just going back to my previous kind of work in the school that I did, and we were working in volleyball, and the danger is, especially if you're in a sport that is not necessarily widespread. So in the UK, volleyball is a good example. You know, you probably don't know where your local volleyball club is, for example, but you probably know where your local football or rugby club is. But kids who are getting picked up, you know, by a club, and they, you know, they may be 6 foot at the age of 15 and they've got a half decent arm on them, they'll end up playing for their club, their region, their country. And those are training loads that no one is communicating about and no one is aware of, you know, except the athlete who's doing them all. And the number of times we would, you know, send a kid off to, you know, a junior camp and they would come back in bits because they did three sessions a day for 5 days in a row, you know, at the age of 15, is probably not a great idea. So this, I think, it is improving, but it could still be better, I think, is a kind of a good attitude to take.
For sure, yeah. With that, I just picked up on something you said there about a 15-year-old that could come in at 6 foot. As we all know, there'd be another one that's 5 foot nothing. With regards to periods of accelerated growth, peak height velocity and areas like that, is there anything in place in the environment that you work in terms of a different gym program for those guys? Is there any proprioception work? Or would that be on the track or in the gym with you? And is there anything put in place, or would you ever consider it? Have you experienced that before?
Yeah, so certainly in my kind of previous practice, we were very kind of regularly measuring, you know, height, seated height, weight, etc. And certainly in those sports where physical attributes are highly emphasized, so in volleyball, for example, and this is, and actually in basketball, when I was working for London Thunder, we experienced 6'3", 4, 14-year-old boys, you know, which is obviously not normal. That's pretty much an outlier, and you know that you're going to get certain issues with that in terms of loading and growth and, you know, potential injury risk factors. I think it's a difficult one in the rugby at the setup that we have at the moment. I don't think it's an ideal scenario. I think it would be better if we monitored those things more closely or more regularly. So outside of kind of national testing, allocated weeks, etc., where they will take seated height, standing height, weight, etc., there's not an ongoing kind of closely monitored protocol, which I think is an area for improvement, because it then opens those discussions. Whereas if you're not collecting that data, you're not seeing the trends, that then doesn't open discussion for, well, what do we do with this? What do we do now? And I think there's a danger, certainly in a collision sport, that you end up selecting those guys who are your outliers, but then you're not tailoring training to those guys. So it becomes problematic if you're not monitoring it more closely.
Very interesting to hear. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there as well. Definitely interesting. Okay, next topic or next question. In your role, how closely do you work with the physiotherapy team? So when you've got the boys that have got injured and they're close to returning, or they're still in the rehab setting, are you involved with that area? And if so, how closely?
At present, as a part-time contractor working within one site, I'm not hugely involved in terms of alongside the physio. And as I mentioned, it kind of varies how closely, in terms of, you know, physically speaking, the two are situated in terms of physio and strength conditioning. So in the current setting, if a guy is carrying an injury or carrying a knock, then they'll kind of be advised, okay, you know, this could be on a Tuesday morning, for example, okay, well, come in on Friday and see the physio. So there's a number of days there, kind of lag, that something could happen. And then the communication obviously will then happen from Friday onwards in terms of, you know, whether someone is ready for training loads or is advised to kind of avoid something altogether. I think in that situation, which is probably where a lot of people are working at the lower end of the scale in terms of maybe academy setups that are part-time, etc., that's where your common sense comes in. And, you know, we all, whilst we're not physios, we have some understanding of, you know, it's probably not a great idea to load that area, or it's probably, you know, if someone's complaining of some tightness, there's some basic kind of mobility, you know, work-ons we could maybe look at to see if that will improve. Beyond the high kind of high impact collision, you know, collision kind of injuries where you're like, okay, that's going to need to be immobilized and looked at properly. So there is an element of common sense, I think, applied when you're not working as closely as you'd like to be with a physio. Certainly in previous roles. I've been, so thinking back to my role at Leaf, I was sat next to the physio, who was my kind of department lead. So in that situation, there's an incredibly close discussions and a very good communication that happens, which unfortunately, when you have that physical distance separates, the kind of communication distance follows suit. So it can become more difficult. Luckily, at higher stages up in the kind of academy setup, that there is that proximity of the physio and the strength and coach that obviously allows for those discussions to take place and for players to get seen on a more regular basis and for monitoring to happen more closely. So at the current stage, it's not as joined up as it could be in terms of the potential lag behind in terms of time. But certainly as players progress through, there's more opportunities for them to see physios and more opportunities for them to get rehab, to have more close kind of protocols and monitoring put in place.
Mm. It's difficult, isn't it, with it being a part-time contractor thing. It's difficult to sort of balance or to work in the detail. Well, I'd imagine it to work in the detail that you'd like. But I'd imagine there's a lot of people out there that are in the same sort of boat in terms of just starting their career, or the circumstances are that they're part-time in one place and then at another. I was just wondering, advice-wise, have you got anything for guys like that could be listening in terms of how do you balance out those two and maximise them both and do your best at them both, and also enjoy your off time and have a work-life balance?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, we've all seen those jobs that are, you know, maybe match day physios at football academies or training session physios where they might have, you know, a head academy physio who is full-time, but then there's maybe three or four kind of casual contractor physios, if you like, that will come in and out. So even within the physiotherapy department, you're going to have some communication issues when people aren't freely available 24/7. Certainly when you then kind of blending that with strength and conditioning, there's obviously also going to be some difficulty there. I think a lot of it is reading outside your area and understanding the basic principles of, you know, rehab in terms of, you know, maybe planes of movement, maybe different stability issues that might be available, and being aware of how you address that in your normal program anyway. So I think having a wide reference point in terms of progressions and regressions, and my kind of attitude, particularly with youth athletes, because it's something you want to embed early, is, yeah, okay, we might have an affected area in A, but that means we are not limited in B. So for example, you know, okay, yeah, we might have an ATFL sprain on our ankle, but that doesn't mean we can't do our trunk work and do our upper body work. Or it doesn't mean we can't maybe do some single leg stuff on the other leg. So, you know, trying to get the attitude into young players early is an important thing, because actually, you know, if you wait the 4 weeks for your ATFL to be fully healed or whatever it is before you get back into working, well, that's some lag time you've had in your other areas that you could have been improving on. And there's, you know, there's always going to be an area to improve. So I think identifying, yeah, okay, we can, you know, we don't want to risk further injury to this area, so let's wait until someone medically trained has seen it. But in the meantime, can we progress in another area? Or can we do something that's not going to stress that particular limb or that particular injury by focusing somewhere else? And getting players to understand that you're not incapacitated because you've got an ATFL strain. There's work you can be doing. So there's that element. And I think also the element of common sense is really important. So saying, okay, you know, we all understand some basic mechanisms of injury. If it sounds like it's going to have caused a bit of trauma and caused something that maybe needs a closer look, then we can look at, you know, we'll hold off and play it safe. But if we know, okay, it's a basic knock, or it's maybe a dead leg, or it's, you know, a real mild ankle sprain, okay, well, we know we're probably going to need a period of rest and immobilization and some icing, and then we're probably going to need to look at a period of proprioception and stability work. Like, it's not, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure that out. But I think it's experience is another big one. So to give you a good example, recently I came off my bike and dislocated my AC joint. And, you know, at the time, very frustrating, very annoying, you know, in the middle of training for something specific. And, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later, I had a player who'd done exactly the same injury in a different mechanism in collision. So I could directly take my experience, my AC joint sprain, and apply, okay, well, I know the issues I had with sleeping and causing pain. I know the first ranges of motion that returned. I knew what was the last thing that fell into place, and being able to match that up and say, okay, what was your experience? You know, are you having trouble sleeping in particular positions? Are you having trouble in the frontal plane, in the sagittal plane? You know, what are the last bits of range of motion to return for you? So, you know, taking that practical experience as well is an important factor.
Definitely. There's so many things in there that you said that I wish I could tell my younger self. But as you say, it's experience, isn't it? And that's why we do these things. And that's why it's so important to go out and get some experience in as many areas as possible. Mm. Okay, brilliant stuff, mate. Final thing. Again, it's because I like Desert Island Discs, which might be a bit sad for a 26-year-old to listen to Radio 4. But I wanted to ask one book that you'd recommend to other practitioners in the area, something that's affected you or you think you've learned a lot from, and you could recommend to other people out there.
Yes, certainly. So I thought of the kind of classic ones that people should read and are probably going to get recommended over the next coming months. That are, you know, on every reading list, whether you're, you know, into those ones from Jim Rohn, etc., you'll always see the same kind of ones pop up. But I actually kind of came back to a book that I was given when I left my last job by kind of team leader. And it's actually a book that was written after a TED Talk this guy did. So a lot of people will probably see this TED Talk. It's an incredibly dry American economist, and he's the title of his talk is Why You Will Fail to Have a Great Career. And it's very, if you're into that sense of humor, it's quite amusing to watch, and he does a very good job of kind of pulling apart why people don't achieve their ambitions, their aspirations, their career. So the book is called No Fears, No Excuses, What You Need to Do to Have a Great Career by a guy called Larry Smith.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. I'll definitely be checking that out.
Yeah, it's probably not one people have heard of.
No, yeah, that's exactly what we want, though. We want to open people's eyes and minds to different things.
Yeah, and I think given how difficult strength conditioning is to break into and to stay in, and the number of people flooding out of universities with degrees and accreditations and qualifications coming out of our ears, and being in such a competitive industry, I think a book like this is very applicable for probably everyone listening, because obviously that's what we all want. We all want to have a great career. So, yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Thank you for that, yeah. And thank you very much for joining me, Rob. Absolute pleasure. I'm sure some really interesting stuff there, some stuff that people can listen to and learn from and take stock and think about where they are and what they're doing. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Not a problem. I hope the quality was all right. It was useful.
So thank you for listening, everybody. As mentioned before, feel free to leave some feedback, whether that be on my Twitter at coach_joycey, JOYCEY, or a comment on the actual podcast itself. Thank you very much for listening, and hopefully see you next time.